Recording.
So we currently have a motion and a second to deny the request for rehearing or review.
Continuing the discussion.
Yes, thank you.
The issue of hearing from the daughter secondhand would be the only reason for us to reconsider this case. However, during the informal, I found the complainant answers to be clear and therefore more credible than the answers of the respondent. And so when we're looking at more likely than not, I would still stand by that I felt the, if it occurred the way the complainant said, then that did not meet the standard, and I felt she was more credible, and the other evidence did not offset that, so I would stand with the motion that I have.
Any other discussion? Dr. James or Jane, do you have anything?
No, this is Dr. James. I don't have anything.
And this is Solomon. I don't have anything.
So regarding the kind of some of the things that were presented by Mr. Flynn, I think that at least my understanding from other cases where we've had she said, is that we do have to take into account who is more credible when we're going over the testimony. And so we look at a lot of medical records too, and again, reviewing, you know, the medical records. At least that's my understanding from that case, was that, you know, given all the information that we had, and yes, you know, we heard from at least her team in through affidavit, that's how we settled on the case, was through who essentially we found more believable in this particular portion of the case. If we have nothing else to add, then we can call, go ahead and vote. Should we roll call?
Dr. Byrne, aye. Ms. Frost?
Aye.
Dr. James?
Aye.
Dr. Nosley?
Did you guys hear me?
Yes. Dr. Nosley?
Aye.
Ms. Solomon?
Solomon, aye.
Dr. Thompson is refused.
Okay. So that motion passes. This concludes the matter. The board's decision will be reduced to a written order and served to Dr. Wildflower. Thank you all for attending today.
Thank you.
Do you have any other changes? Okay. Before we get started on the IIRs, we'll just. So we're going to go ahead and just run through what order that we'll hear the IIRs. We'll have to write a second. Find a chair. So we're going to start with 2, number 7, case 24-117. Then we'll go to the four-pack, 24-108, 24-109, 24-110, and 24-111. We'll go to 24-116. Then we'll go down to number 12-2509. And then we'll start back up at the top.
Hey, Nikki, this is Robin, and I just want to let you know that I'm going to drop off now.
Oh, yeah, okay. Thank you. So, for the record, Dr. James is leaving the meeting, and Dr. Wright has returned, and Dr. Thompson, he has appeared. Okay, so I think we have all of that. So we'll go ahead and call to number seven, case 24-117 regarding Kennedy Schultz DVM. We don't have the respondent or...
She did not have counsel.
Okay. So we'll go ahead and have Tracy, if you can read the summary on the case.
Case 24-117, the complainant is Gina Logrande. The respondent is Kennedy Schultz, DVM. On February 14th, 2024, Murphy, a 14-year-old male pit bull mix, was presented to respondent on emergency due to shaking his head and scratching at his ear. Respondent evaluated the dog, performed an ear cytology, cleaned the ears, and prescribed Momentamax for otitis externa. By February 18th, 2024, complainant noted the dog had lost its hearing. The Momentamax was discontinued. On February 20th, 2024, the dog was presented to Life Care Animal Hospital for evaluation. The dog's hearing loss was confirmed, and it was suspected to be a side effect of the ear medication. A referral to a neurologist was declined at that time, and complainant elected to monitor the dog for improvement. On March 1st, 2024, the dog presented to Life Care Animal Hospital for a recheck. Complainant felt the dog had some improvement. Dr. Barnett could not appreciate any improvement in the dog's hearing, and due to the dog's head shaking and restlessness, an antibiotic and a sedative were prescribed. Complainant expressed concerns that they were not made aware of the known risks associated with using Momentamax before it was dispensed to the dog. And the committee concluded that no violation of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred, and it was moved and seconded that the board dismiss this issue of no violation. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Thank you. So I believe that we have the complainant present, Gina.
And David Stoll.
Here. Oh, you're monitoring? Are you?
Yeah, monitoring.
Okay. All right, thank you. So if you could identify yourself.
Sure. My name is Gina LeGrand, and I am the owner of Murphy, a 14-year-old pit mix.
All right. And so you can have up to 5 minutes to address the board. We do have the materials that you submitted, so if you have anything new that you'd like to add.
Yeah, there isn't anything new. I just wanted to make it clear that the information that we were provided with written instructions, so I just want to make that clear. And those written instructions in no way indicated that there was a risk to the dog's hearing, that if we use this medication, that the dog would potentially lose his hearing, especially because he was geriatric. Once he began to exhibit signs of hearing loss, I went on to the Merck website, and the distributor clearly identifies that there is a potential risk for hearing loss in geriatric dogs. So my biggest concern with the situation is that had this been a child, the risks of the medication would have been made very clear to me, and I would have been able to make an informed decision about whether or not to treat the child. Because I wasn't given that information, I went ahead and treated the dog, trusting in the documentation that I was given, and that resulted in hearing loss. So my concern is that we're not doing our dogs justice when we don't provide owners, the only people who can speak for the animal, with all of the information required to make a good decision. Because had I been told that this was a risk, I would have absolutely not given the dog the drug, clearly. So that's really all I have to say. I'm not sure what I'm expecting out of this. There's nothing I'm really asking for, but something does need to change in how, you know, these medications are administered and how knowledge is being delivered to people.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I just had a question. Just a minor question, if that's possible.
Just 1 second.
Sorry.
You can sit there for a second then. We do have Dr. Nosley as the lead on this case.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to go ahead and...
I don't have any questions.
Okay.
I just had a quick question about the dispensing of the medication.
Sure.
How did you get the medication? What was given to you at that point?
We were given a tube. My husband's actually the person who brought the dog in. I didn't bring the dog into the veterinary clinic. We were given a tube of Momentamax, and I'm the person who administered the medication, so I gave him 3 doses. I gave him a dose on the 15th, a dose the next day, and a dose the day after that, and it was on the 18th that I noticed that he began to have a problem. And I only treated the one ear. I didn't treat both ears, so I only treated the one ear, and that's the ear that has the loss.
Okay. Sorry, just when you say tube, it comes in like a little...
Yeah, like one of those little...
With a long...
Like, yeah, container, okay. With a little, you know, so that you can drop it in, yeah.
And did it come in a box, or?
It did come in a box.
Okay.
It did come in a box.
And was there the drug information? Do you remember?
I mean, honestly, okay. I don't remember okay. if the drug information was there, but you know, because you know, they provided me with a sheet, you know, I assumed that this was all I really needed to have. And because she didn't articulate any other risks, knowing that the dog was the age he was, that was the concern.
Yeah, no, I understand. I was curious
sure.
if it came in the original packaging
yes.
or not. So thank
as
you
far
so
as I know, yes.
It's hard to recreate those otherwise.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, this case obviously revolves around the drug Mometamax. A very, very commonly used topical otic preparation. Been around for many, many years. Various, even different names, Otomax, I remember a couple others, but they all have the same formula containing three drugs, an antibiotic, gentamicin, an antifungal, and a steroid. And that's why, one of the reasons why it's very effective in treating bacterial and yeast infections in dogs' ears. According to the labeling and drug formularies, there are some precautions regarding gentamicin. That's the antibiotic in there. It's an aminoglycoside, and those drugs have potential for some toxicity, most notably kidney toxicity, but that's in the injectable form. Ototoxicity is mentioned. The drug potentially can be toxic to the structures of the middle ear, and I think that's the key here. References will state that best practice is to make sure that the tympanic membranes or the eardrums are intact before using this to avoid having a large concentration of gentamicin into the middle ear. There are times, however, when you have so much debris in a dog's ear that you can't see the tympanic membrane, and I have used it in that case. In this case, however, both the emergency vet and the primary vet state in the record that both tympanic membranes were intact. The labeling also references prolonged contact with the structures of the middle ear. Apparently this patient only had a few doses, one at the ER, and then, as we just heard, a few more doses. So this vestibular toxicity are usually seen after long-term, high-dose, systemic treatment with gentamicin. We didn't have systemic, we had topical treatment. And so we have this deafness issue. First of all, deafness is extremely difficult to assess in the dog in general, but certainly in one ear, deafness would be very, very hard to assess. It's very difficult to diagnose in a clinical setting whether you have a true deafness or not. I've found in my experience that owners are pretty good at determining deafness in most cases, but it's hard in a clinical setting. Now, neurologists, they have the ability to do some testings. They put the ear things on the dog and measure some responses and that kind of thing. Because deafness is so difficult to determine, and the degree of it in the dog. So in this patient, it was apparent that the deafness was complete, according to the owner, in both ears. And so the mechanism for ototoxicity concerns exposure to the structures of the middle ear. Well, you can't get high concentrations of gentamicin in the middle ear if the tympanic membranes are intact. So it's apparent that something was going on with this patient, as is evidenced by the symptoms were exhibited. But the only way to determine what might possibly would be a workup by a neurologist, I certainly understand that the timing of this hearing issue would cause concern to the owner and cause them to question the drug. But I just don't see enough evidence based on all the materials, and particularly two veterinarians saying that the eardrums were intact, that the Mometamax gentamicin would be a reason to suspect for the hearing loss. So I would make a motion in case 24-117 to agree with the investigative committee and dismiss with no violation.
Second.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Having none, go ahead and vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion has passed, dismissed with no violation. Board staff will be in touch. Thank you. So now we have a case 24-10. Oh, sorry.
I'd love to know, did hearing come back? Did it come back?
He still has no hearing on the left side and full hearing on the right, which is what was always the case.
Okay,
thank you. So he didn't lose hearing on the right side, he only lost it on the treated ear.
Okay, thank you. Just curious.
So now we have case 24-108, 24-109, 24-110, and 24-111. So, Tracy, would you be able to read the summary? Is the summary the same on all four?
Yes, the summary is okay. The same for all four cases. So, 24-108, Alexandria Armini DVM, 24-109, Janet Bailey DVM, 24-110, Peter Bondi Jr. DVM, 24-111, Stanley Rubin DVM, and the complainant is Mr. Gregory Billings. Emma, a 7+-year-old female Staffordshire Terrier was MIPS, was diagnosed with heartworm disease in July of 2022. Later in the month, the dog was presented to BCA Valley Animal Hospital and Emergency Center due to respiratory distress and was hospitalized for oxygen therapy for several days. Throughout the next year and a half, the dog was presented to Valley Animal Hospital for care and treatment for pulmonary hypertension, coughing, proteinuria, and dyspnea. Dr. Armini, Dr. Bailey, Dr. Bondi, and Dr. Rubin had all cared for the dog at one point or had conversations with complainant during the dog's hospitalizations. Complainant expressed concerns that the veterinarians did not provide adequate care for the dog in her final hours. Complainant's instructions were not followed. Complainant was not allowed limited visitation time for the dog. The dog's blanket was malodorous, and the euthanasia procedure was not handled in a professional manner. And the committee concluded that no violation of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred, and it was moved and seconded that the board dismissed these issues with no violation. And the motion was made with a vote of 4-1.
Okay. So we don't have respondents present, but we do have Council Monterey? That's correct. Monterey? Okay. Thank you. And then we do have the complainant, Mr. Greg Billings, present. If you'd just like to state your name for the record.
Gregory Billings.
Right, thank you. So you have up to 5 minutes to address the board. We did receive your materials that were submitted, so if you have anything new you'd like to add.
I will say that I don't have a record. I heard that comment in a previous case that alluded to a record. I have no record of what Dr. Bondi did. I have no record of what Dr. Bailey did. I only have what they told me, and that's basically what was entered into the records, my testimony. That's probably not a whole lot, because while I spent probably 2.6% of the 75 hours of her hospitalization actually with her, I didn't talk to the veterinarians. I did spend some time with Dr. Bailey, but she was going on vacation. Dr. Bondi, who assumed responsibility for Emma's care when Dr. Bailey left to go on vacation, said four things to me over the course of Emma's hospitalization. And I don't know what he said to me, but I know what he said to me. And those four things were, I'm gonna stop you right there in response to my objection to being able to see my dog, which is a critical part of her care. I was with her pretty much from the moment that she was dumped in North Carolina by a family in the neighborhood that I lived in until the moment she died. But I was not able to see her during that last hospitalization. Previous ones, I'd go into the ICU. When they would ask me to leave, I would go. I objected to that, and that was his response to me. I'm gonna stop you right there. As far as his treatment of my dog, as far as presenting me with clinical information, I didn't get any clinical information. I'm gonna keep doing what I'm doing until you tell me otherwise. That doesn't help me to assess my dog. Not being able to see her doesn't help me to assess my dog. At one point, I was looking at the chart, and the chart, it was an evening, and I was looking at the chart, and the chart said, pulmonary type hypertension, diagnosed with pulmonary hypertension, and on and on. Emma's principal problem was eosinophilic pneumonitis. There's not a whole lot that can be done for that. I understand that. I wanted her death to be a death on her own terms, not on the terms that were consigned to her by the family who abandoned her. And that didn't happen. And I gave specific instructions. So Dr. Bondi and I had a discussion, and one of the things he said to me was, if this were my dog, I wouldn't be doing this. That doesn't tell me what's going on with her. That just tells me what he would do if it were his dog, and she was not. And the last thing he told me the day that her, she died was that she had collapsed. And when I went to see her, I said, I'm not signing anything until I go take a look at her, and I did, and she had food particles all over her face. And I asked for a cloth, and the vet tech looked at me with a blank stare, and I went and found a cloth because I knew where they were, wetted it down, and cleaned her face. That tells me that she was struggling when they were trying to medicate her. All they had to do was what Dr. Bailey would do when she was struggling, when she would be resistant. Call me. I live 70 miles away. And I can't tell you how many times I would go up there during her hospitalizations to do whatever the staff needed for me to do to assist them. I gave the technician specific instructions as to that Emma was not to be removed from the kennel during the procedure. She told me that I could spend as much time with her. And shortly after I signed the document, I got a tap on my shoulder, and I turn around, and Dr. Bondi, I don't have a K95 mask, but he was wearing a K95 mask, and he had a flask of base liquid, and he stuck it out in front of his chest like this, just like this. Okay? Now, I'm no expert on any of this, but I talked to my wife. My wife encouraged me to be there when Emma died, and my wife said it's a two-shot procedure. So I don't know whether Dr. Bondi had another shot, but I wouldn't know because he took Emma and he pushed her head down. And I wasn't with her when she died because I had to get out of the way for some technician and a doctor. And that was Dr. Bailey said to me, that's not on me, that's on you, whether she dies or not. Well, if you've got to do something, contrary to my instructions, I'm the client, you do what I tell you to do. Those are my orders, and my orders were not followed. I'm sorry I'm yelling. The only other thing I would tell you is when I looked at the orders, and this was Pat, this was in every other room, they would send me, I would get an update in the evening, and I would get an update in the morning from the ICU veterinarian that was on staff. I never got that. So I made a reflex decision based on Dr. Bondi telling me that she collapsed. But I will tell you for the record, I don't know if I said this before during the interview, her clinical presentation was not that bad. And I realize that's a layman's talk, but I know my dog. I knew my dog. I had her for 24 hours, pretty much. Except one time I went to San Diego because I had to go to a conference for my job. She was having trouble. I brought her. The other thing I would mention is that Dr. Bailey, I got a lot of misinformation. I got from Dr. Rubin, you know, we can help you take her home. And that was to take her to Sierra Vista, where I knew she wasn't going to survive because it's 4,600 feet there. So I got an Airbnb in October and in Tucson, and I kept her there. And on the other hand, he was telling me, well, she's not going to survive if I take her to the 4 miles to the Airbnb. You know, I don't know what to do because nobody sat down and said to me, this is what her prognosis is. And that's a problem. That's a problem. And somebody interviewing me, saying to me, well, if you wanted her to die at home, what'd you bring her to the hospital for? That doesn't help either. That's all I have. Thank you for listening.
So I'm very sorry for your loss. Can you go ahead and step back? Dr. Wright, you are the lead on these cases, so we understand the summary is the same. So do you want to start with discussion on 24-108?
Yes. So thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony and your information, too, Mr. Billings. Going through and reading this, I mean, this is all basically not centered around the heart disease, not necessarily centered around the pulmonary issues or anything like that. It's kind of around, it sounds like, the process of euthanasia and the customer service portion of this case as opposed to the medical portion. When I look at the medical records, which is the only thing we have purvey over, we don't have any kind of business acumen regulations that we have that we can deal with. When I look at the medical portion, I don't see issues in the medical portion. I see that the patient was treated as we were, or as we should be for this. Unfortunately, when it comes to this underlying disease, when you start having complications, there's really nothing you can do. I mean, I don't know what class this patient was, or 1, 2, or 3, but if we're having respiratory distress, we're either a 2 or 3 in most cases. And when you have a class 3, you basically have to get in there and take those worms out of the heart immediately. If it's already dislodged and gone to the lungs, you basically just give steroids, oxygen, and hope. So there's really medically nothing that I can see that was wrong, that was problematic, that was against our regulations and statutes here. Again, when it comes to the euthanasia portion itself, that's just a difficult thing. We get a lot of complaints about euthanasia because everybody looks at it a different way. And death, even though it's something that all of us are going to share one day, hopefully not anytime soon, is one of the most difficult things to witness. So it doesn't necessarily matter what happens. It's never easy to see someone or something you love die. Could things have been handled differently? Possibly. I mean, we're getting the one side there. We have our testimony from the doctors. But when it comes down to instructions from the client and that kind of stuff, my medical directions are what are going to happen. I mean, a client can make recommendations, can ask questions, but I'm not going to have a client dictating medicine because that's what I'm here for. That's my license, that's what I went to school for, that's what my knowledge is. So I understand that the instructions weren't followed, but that's not something I would be expecting anyway. I mean, suggestions, yes, and all that. But I think, unfortunately, here, there's a lot more grief as opposed to medical issues going on. So based on all that, I make a motion to dismiss this with no violation.
Second.
I have a motion and a second. Any other discussion on case 24-108? What you were saying, Dr. A, as far as like the medical piece, I mean, we do have a piece with, you know, communication.
Yeah.
And it's really challenging in a situation that, I mean, there's obviously a lot of investment in Emma and her, you know, well-being and taking care of her and feeling a sense of responsibility to her having, you know, good experience. Personally, having, you know, work in ICU situations, it can be a challenge, you know, to make sure that they get kind of more of that home feeling, because it's not their home. You know, we have lights on most of the day. We try to shut those off, but it's just, it can be disconcerting. And so it's tough because visiting them, sometimes they get more anxious, you know, they don't know why you're leaving, and it can stress, you know, for their humans and for our patients. They, you know, there's a lot of stress. So I sympathize with that.
And it's a good point. I mean, when you look at humans, we look at hospice in most cases as we're dying. And that's a whole different specialty in veterinary medicine for a reason. Hospice care is not something that can actually be done in an ICU setting. And that's a very different thing, unfortunately.
Yeah. Compassion rooms.
Compassion is huge.
Things that type of thing. Yeah. And I think sometimes it's lost on how stressful and emotional it is for the veterinarian, also in euthanasias. Is this the respondent that the statement of stop you right there? Is that this one?
No.
Okay. But this is the euthanasia
respondent. No, this was the original one. This was
Dr. Armini.
Hold on, I got to pull it up again. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Armini.
Okay. I heard some things that I wanted to address regarding some of the other.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So we do have a motion and a second. So any more discussion? All is in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? None. That motion passes. Now, 24-109.
All right, so let's pull 24-109 now. So this one is for Dr. Bailey. So this is the second on the list there, starting at number 10. So again, when you go through this same kind of discussion we just had, when it comes to this case, I don't see any medical issues that are problematic that rise to the level of a statute violation. So I'll make a motion to dismiss this with no violation.
Second, Solomon.
A motion and a second. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay.
Aye.
Opposed? None. That motion passes. Case 24-110.
All right, so for 24-110, this is Dr. Bondi. Is this one you had questions on?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I just wanted to make a statement that the stop you right there wasn't in reference to her medical care. That was in reference to, that's a hospital policy and a hospital rule, and I'm not the one to address those complaints to. So I'm not sure that was really clear on the complainant's mind, the stop you right there. That had to do with rules.
And unfortunately, when it comes to rules, it's not just rules of the hospital, it's rules that are handed down by our federal government, mainly OSHA.
Sure.
And when you look at a treatment area, that's governed by OSHA laws, and really, we are not allowed to have any non-medical staff back there. Most hospitals do make exceptions when they can, but by federal statute with OSHA, we are not allowed to have anybody back there. So sometimes, we just can't do that. And especially when you look at certain hospitals, and especially when you look at the corporate ownership portion of certain hospitals, they're gonna follow laws a lot closer than a lot of private practice as well. And that's just unfortunately a shift that we're going to. But just like in human medicine, you can't demand to go into an OR. You're not gonna be able to demand to do anything in the hospital because of OSHA.
Well, because of that very thing, you know, questions would be, the VEG, V-E-G group, yeah, totally different.
Yeah, it's separate rooms, I think, though, or something with that one. But yeah, there's ways in that regard. But again, it's a huge dynamic shift.
Yeah.
But when it comes to being in the back treatment area, And I said, that is unfortunately something that if there's a hospital policy, that's actually just following federal law and statute.
And the other thing was the collapse that was mentioned. It wasn't a collapse for the medical, the disease process going on. They were attempting to take the dog out. And she was obviously too weak and couldn't support her weight. So it wasn't collapsed. We're decompensating. It was a weakness thing.
Almost similar to like a syncope type thing where you just have the lack of
blood flow. You're just
too weak. Yeah, just can't do anything.
The diet at home, that never works.
No.
It's sad. We'd all wish that could be.
Yeah, just fall asleep and never wake up.
Yeah.
That rarely happens.
Yeah, rarely. Unfortunately, then we have to go through what similar to what happened in this case, a euthanasia in the hospital.
Which, unfortunately, as hard as euthanasia is, it's better than coughing up blood and choking on your own.
Exactly.
Which would be the ultimate case here.
Which would be what would happen.
With this disease.
I agree. That's all I had.
Thank you. This is just a difficult case. It's a very hard one, but again, medically, I don't see anything that was wrong in 24-110. So I'll make a motion to dismiss her violation.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. That motion passes. And then case at 24-111.
For 24-111, that's Dr. Rubin. Again, looking through this, still not saying that it's kind of more conversation in that the gift portion and all, but which I've used that. Sometimes it's the best gift you can give.
We try to find
I don't see any medical statute violations, so I make a motion to dismiss with no violation.
Second.
Yeah, a motion and a second. Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. That motion passes. So that concludes this matter, and the board will be in touch. Again, we're very sorry for your loss.
Yes.
Okay, so case 24-116 regarding Nilan Gupta. Looks like Tracy, if you could read the summary, please.
Sure. Case 24-116. The complainant is Barbara Cholsky. The respondent is Nilan Gupta, DVM. On February 15th, 2024, a 6-year-old female Jack Russell Terrier was presented to respondent due to vomiting, drooling, and lethargy. A sufficient blood sample could not be obtained due to dog's dehydration. Therefore, only a CBC was performed. The dog received sub-Q fluids and radiographs were performed. No foreign body was noted. Respondents' differential diagnosis were pancreatitis, neoplasia, dietary indiscretions, splenic contraction, and other. No definitive diagnosis was made since a chemistry panel could not be conducted. Complainant was referred to an emergency facility for diagnostics and treatment. If complainant was unable to go to an emergency facility, it was recommended to bring the dog back the next day to try to get blood for testing and IV fluid therapy. The dog was administered Serenia and discharged with gabapentin. On February 16, 2024, the dog was presented to respondent in critical condition. Again, respondent referred the dog to an emergency facility and offered humane euthanasia. Complainant wanted respondent to treat the dog while she looked into possible transfer to an emergency facility. Respondent still could not obtain a sufficient blood sample for testing. An IV catheter was placed and fluids were initiated. Later that day, complainant picked up the dog and transferred her to an emergency facility. After diagnostics were performed at the emergency facility, the dog was diagnosed with kidney failure. Complainant elected to humanely euthanize the dog. Complainant reported in her complaint that it was her idea to take the dog to an emergency facility, not respondent's. Furthermore, respondent misdiagnosed the dog with pancreatitis, not pancreatitis. And the committee concluded that no violation of the Veterinary Practice Act had occurred, and it was moved and seconded. The board dismissed this issue with no violation. The motion was approved with a vote of 4-0.
Thank you. So I believe we do have a respondent and counsel.
Monitor.
Oh, so you're monitoring, no statement?
No.
Dr. Gupta?
No.
All right, thank you. And then, let's see, no complainant. So we have Dr. Thompson, you're the lead.
So this is a tough case in that location plays a lot in how the animal was tended to. It is really difficult when we're in very kind of rural areas and we don't have a lot of care. I did have some questions. And I also have been in that situation where you have a patient that is very difficult to get an adequate blood sample on to get all the pertinent information that you need. But I guess I have some questions as far as the treatment that was given on that first day and then the subsequent day when the pet came back and received fluid therapy, given how dehydrated the animal was that an adequate treatment plan for the duration of the time that was there? I understand that we were only open for a short period of time. I guess I have questions around the treatment in this case. I know there were some questions that were brought up as far as, you know, why didn't you stay late? That's not a question that I have. We all have to go home at the end of the day. But there's just some things like the medical records and just the treatment of the pet on the first and second day that I have questions on. And so for that, I would recommend going into an informal.
I'll second that.
All right, so we have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? I mean, I guess, like when you look at the complaint, what the complaint is, right, was that he didn't make a referral, which...
Do you want to ask Dr. Gupta questions now?
Is that permissible in this?
Very superficial questions.
Yeah.
Do you have deep questions or do you have like a superficial?
This is be pretty detailed.
I get that the complaint was that he didn't recommend sending to an emergency facility, but isn't it also our responsibility to see other things that could have potentially
been done?
Yeah. Oh, no, I hear what you're saying there. I just wanted to make sure that wasn't one of the things because I feel like that was done.
Yeah.
And then as far as like the diagnosis, if you don't have blood work, made differential diagnoses, but you can't list every single differential diagnosis, right?
Right.
So I just didn't know if that was any of the things because I feel like there's, at least what the committee talked about, I'm just not sure. I was kind of curious what was missing in this.
I guess if we can just have a quick conversation.
We can talk.
Okay. Yeah, we're allowed to talk.
I guess for me, my biggest, yes, I agree. There was a recommendation to go to the emergency room. I get, given where we were at, that's difficult. It's difficult for the doctor in that position. I've only got 2 hours left of my day. I can only do X. I can only get X on this patient. So that's a struggle. There were some minor things that I noted in the notes that were like questionable. It was hard for me to follow. It was actually easier for me to see in the write out of that the board put together than what was in the medical record. I think my biggest concern, I guess, would be the treatment of the patient on the second day. That when we came in and we're recording a 10 to 12% dehydration, like that's really dehydrated and we're giving 90 mils per hour. Like that, and we had that patient for, now granted we didn't have them all day, but we should have been like open, practically open line on that head to give it the best chance. Now would that have changed the outcome? Question mark, right? We don't know. I also see that they talked about the renal failure, which obviously we didn't have values for that, but I've also seen changes in the hematocrit. Were we looking at the HGE? Were we looking at atypical Addison's? So those were, you know, other things that could have been. Were the fluids going to make the difference? Maybe not, but maybe it would have helped a little bit and given them more time on the other end to see if there was something else we could do. I don't know. So if we don't feel that that's in total violation, I could do a letter of concern. But if we felt that it was something that we needed to investigate more, that's where the lead recommendation came from.
I agree with you regarding the second day. Mm-hmm. But I also have concerns on that first day. because we ultimately ended up with the patient going home with a hematocrit of 74%. That's almost not compatible with life. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're close to hypovolemic shock at that point. And to send home on gabapentin. If we would have had some kind of a client communication that said, your dog could die tonight if you don't go to the emergency. And I'm not sure that was expressed that way. So I have questions regarding the first visit and why fluids weren't administered.
Right, and I think those
day one,
my interpretation of the record is that we were on a very, very short time frame. Like, we had the pet for 2 hours. And I also understand you have multiple patients, you've got x-rays that you need, like, I'm trying to put in and think about how that day would go.
Yeah.
But then also, like, why didn't we send home with sub-Q fluids to continue to administer throughout the evening? Like,
I know lots of doctors that won't send sub-Q fluids home.
Yeah,
some doctors. So I'm like, I don't know about that. I
mean, we could
put a
catheter and bolus in. How long does that take to get that?
Well, and again, maybe there's some questions on what the client declined then, right? Because
because
it does, there, at least in the responding veterinarians, right, there's a comment about financial constraints, you know, and things. And so if you're working with very limited amount of time and very limited amount of funds, and you're trying to get the best information with what you have, then you know, you can Monday morning quarterback it all day long.
For sure.
Okay. But I think these
questions. You have a lot more deep questions, because I mean, to me, I can ask you a quick question. Did you make recommendations and that were declined, or do you want to have the back and forth?
So our discussion is the reason for moving to informal. We're all asking these questions that need to be answered.
Okay. So there's a motion and a second.
Okay. Yeah.
Any other discussion?
No, but no, I never had a question. Yeah. Okay,
no, yes, no, okay. all right, so all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The motion passes to move to informal. Okay, and then case 2509, Hugo Santibanez, DVM.
He's coming from Bullhead City. I'm going to offer him a phone call. That was kind of my question.
They can always hear back.
Oh, okay. As long as he knows that, because like I said, I hate a long drive to Vegas for three questions or something.
Tracy, do you want to start on this case?
Yes, sure. Case 2509. The complainant is the Arizona State Veterinary Medical Examining Board. The respondent is Hugo Santibanez. At the July 17, 2024 Arizona State Veterinary Medical Examining Board meeting, the board voted to open investigation for noncompliance with respondent's consent agreement 2453. Respondent entered into a consent agreement with the board due to repeated premises compliance issues. A practice monitor was implemented to assist respondent in getting his premises compliant. The latest report from the practice monitor noted several areas of continued non-compliance. Respondent refutes that the practice monitor states that he is mostly compliant. And this did not go in front of the investigative committee. It was brought straight to you for your review and consideration.
Thank you. So I do believe Dr. Santibanez and his counselor are in attendance.
Yes, I was routine and I gave Tracy a letter last night, so apologize for the delay.
Okay.
Also, would it be permissible, Chair, if someone from his office appears? She's been working to deal with a lot of the compliance issues, and she does have additional materials that might be helpful for the board in looking at the case for today.
Okay, and do we have her?
She is present as well.
Oh, what's her name?
Nina, what's your last name?
Palafox.
Okay, thank you.
Can I have them come up?
Oh, thank you. Yes, please.
I'll take the kid's chair.
We have spares over there.
Oh, that's okay. I
okay, we're all here. If you could all introduce yourselves.
Good
Good morning, Chair, members of the board, Flynn Carey, counsel for the licensee. You can state your name.
My name is Hugo Santibanez.
Good morning, my name is Ina Fox.
Thank you. So you can have up to 5 minutes to address the.
I am going to be mercifully brief on my comments. This is a compliance case. There's a practice monitor. You saw the practice monitor's report. Enith and other members of the veterinary staff have been working to remedy a lot of these items. And now I am on board, so what I would like to be able to be in a position to do is work obviously with my client and obviously the practice monitor, see if we can continue to make some progress. What I envision a deliverable would be within 30 days would be a timeline. Obviously, I'd like to get everything obviously in full compliance, but if there's anything outstanding, a timeline, I'd like to put policies and procedures, and I'd like to be able to come back and avow to the board that we have done an in-service. I'm thinking about a day where we can go through, make sure all staff, both in English and Spanish, have been brought up to speed on all of the policies. I think there's a need for both practice and attorney compliance working together, and I'm obviously committed to do that by being brought on. I would propose having Ms. Palafox kind of walk you through what's already been done so you can see that there is significant movement. She's brought photographs and she's documented the heck out of them so you can see just kind of what the state of the vet clinic is right now. But then what I would suggest or at least propose is if the board would be comfortable tabling it, allowing us to submit some additional documents and then making a determination if an informal is necessary. That may be an approach. Obviously though, because I've just been brought on, I'm asking for a little bit of runway so that I can ensure that compliance is happening. And I did introduce myself to the compliance or the practice monitor, so I think my hope is that we'll be able to work effectively together and start moving things along. I do have Enith here, and she can show you the changes that have been made just for the physical site, which includes, I think, one of the big through lines was some clutter, organization, and she. There are photographs that are notated. I don't need to call your attention to anything in particular on those, but just so you can get a sense that this is, the practice monitor report did not fall on deaf ears, and there's significant movement being made.
And this is since the last report we've
received? It is incremental. These are since the last report. There have been some changes made based upon her initial report and her initial work with the clinic. I think this is a much more significant change to the physical site. And if she, if the practice monitor obviously is willing to continue to work with the practice, I would be happy to also work with her and make sure that we can get a compliance officer for the clinic to work directly with her.
And sorry, compliance officer, somebody that is employed?
Correct, yeah, we would designate someone internally. Typically when I've had surgical sites, like at DHS, when we've had these issues, our first step is always to designate a compliance officer. And they're the point of contact so that procedures get written, they run point on the in-services that need to be done with employees. It's just you have a point of contact. What happens sometimes, as I'm sure you've seen in practices, if it gets distributed, if the responsibilities start getting distributed without a point of contact, sometimes things can slip. Having a designated person is always what we recommend as attorneys on these cases.
Did you have anything to add beyond the information you're providing in photos?
I also went back and looked at the reviewed files that were submitted in the report stating if we've had a full recovery on them. I noticed that one of the patients had passed away and was put down at the clinic, and after that one, it seemed like it was a very grave case where it wasn't too much that we could do to help fill the owner. And the other cases, there was another one where we had a full recovery. His name was Snowball, and it even says on the last outgoing recheck exam that says apparent and healthy patient or apparent and healthy pet, just to state that we are doing a recovery checkup on the patients after surgery.
Okay, and that's in regards to your anesthetic law?
Yes.
We've also provided them with the premises inspection document that the board utilizes, and we're making recommendations on how to utilize that effectively in the practice as well. So.
Our compliance manager that we recommended to have for the office has studied at the Pima University Institute with Christian and as well knows Katie, and she is very familiar with the regulations. She's been going to be certified in October as a technician.
She's taking her exams?
Yes.
Is the board aware that the practice monitor is here, if they want to talk to the practice monitor?
Yes, we'll get there. Anything else that you'd like to add?
Nothing from us.
Okay, all right. Thank you. You got to kind of step back. Thank you. We'll take a look at this. So we do have the practice monitor, Katie, present. Would you come forward, please?
And Katie is the practice monitor that was approved by the board. Yeah, he hired her.
Yes.
Through this consent order.
Hello. Hi. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Katie Carpenter.
Thank you. So we asked you to step forward because you did provide the report to the board, and we had opened the case as a result of that report that was received. Dr. Wright, you are the lead. And again, I know that this is an initial investigative review for non-compliance. But because of the nature of the report, I don't know if you have any specific questions, Dr. Wright.
Not before we have an executive session, so that'll be my first.
I just have a question. You were hired by Dr. Santibanez.
Yes.
How long have you been with the practice, just so that?
I think it was February or March. I followed the guidelines of he had up to 60 days to find somebody and within 30 days for me to start. And that's when I did an observation, and that is kind of what the first report was. And then we started implementing changes and things like that after that.
Okay.
And I was there almost weekly, depending on the week. So it wasn't just the monitoring. I gave him the option for me to just come in and take copies and do a report or to help him. And I was there weekly as we were doing things. So that's a lot of that is reflected in my report.
Okay, thank you. Did you have something?
That's what I just wanted to clarify.
Oh, okay. So Dr. Santibanez had you there more frequently as opposed to just for reports?
Correct. Periodically.
Okay. All right. So you want to...
I guess I do have one question. So when are you scheduled to go next?
I wanted to get through this portion of it, and since he had his response and all of that stuff, so we potentially have a meeting for Friday morning, which I actually am going out of town, so I was going to push it until the first week of September. He doesn't know that. I haven't emailed him yet. And I had told him basically after what goes on here, then we could sit down and even determine what to do to move forward. Because it didn't necessarily go how our initial meeting had intended. So I think we need to meet and figure out what the plan would be, not just go right back into what I was doing before.
Okay. But that is here in the next couple of weeks. It's
yes.
Not like 3 months
later. Absolutely. Yes, because I know my next report is still due in the beginning of September.
Cool. So that's my only question there. If anybody else has more right now.
Jane,
so, cool.
Jane, do you have anything? I heard something.
Yeah.
Yes, I do, but it's probably of Flynn Carey.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, this is Solomon. Yes, in the investigative division report, it states the respondent refutes the practice monitor's claim. Does Dr. Santibanez still refute the practice monitor's claim?
I think that there's a combination of some items that he disagrees with and that staff disagree with, and there's others that were remedied. I apologize, Ms. Solomon. I was just retained, so I haven't gone through this with a fine-tooth comb. Wasn't my intent today to push back on the practice monitor. I find that generally working with the practice monitor collaboratively is a better strategy.
Yeah.
So I don't really feel like I can take a position on whether I agree with or disagree with everything. I think what I'm going to be solidly focused on for the next 30 days is making sure that everyone works well together and we can get some written policies, some SOPs, and get a compliance officer in place.
Okay, do you have any comments on the practice monitor's recommendations of having DEA evaluate Dr. Santibanez's controlled substance maintenance and documentation?
Generally, the DEA is not doesn't do inspections in the same way that the vet board, liquor control, and places like that do. They're a little bit more of a reactive agency. I do have Dr. Pete Weinstein and Kelly Detweiler, who run a national DEA compliance program. Kelly is sort of the guru of DEA, And so I, my intention was to have her come in and do compliance on any DEA concerns. I also know that the practice monitor raised some OSHA issues. I've already worked with them on their material safety data sheets and some other items, since I do have a little bit of training in OSHA. So we are well on our way, but there will definitely be a DEA component to this. I just intend to use the DEA attorney and compliance officer that I've utilized in the past, and she would obviously report back once everything is in shape.
Okay.